Welcome to Words First, talking text in opera. One of the first places I worked as a young AD was the Glimmerglass Opera, now the Glimmerglass Festival in upstate New York. This is where I met Kelly Rourke, a dramaturg, librettist, and translator, and one of my guests on today's episode. Kelly is the resident dramaturg at both the Glimmerglass Festival and the Washington National Opera, and has written libretti for numerous song cycles and operas, frequently with John Glover, but also with a host of other composers. She's also known for modern English adaptations of numerous operas and has acted as guest lecturer at a number of universities and librettist mentor for Washington National Opera's American Opera Initiative. Before we speak with Kelly, however, I want to share an interview I did with another Glimmerglass artist, countertenor David Walker. David is the general director of Palm Beach Opera, but before he walked into opera administration, he had an 18-year international performing career throughout the United States, Europe, Australia, and Russia. David and I worked together a number of times when he was performing, and in this conversation, he brought me the aria Voi che udite from Handel and Calzabigi's Agrippina to start us off.
It's such an incredibly beautiful blend of the text with the music. But most importantly, really, this character is the only good guy in the show,
yeah,
give or take. And it's a moment in the show where everyone's turning against him. Everyone in all the characters turn against him, and he's left standing there, devastated, yeah, because he doesn't understand what's happening behind the scenes, and they're all doing calculations to try to get the throne, or there are all those plot devices that are happening, and. What's really special about it, it's probably one of the only moments that I remember in Handel opera or even in performing where the singer or the character actually breaks down the fourth wall and talks directly to yeah. the audience. It's very rare. Yeah. It's very rare. It could be, I remember when we were doing all the directing for this and going through this, the study of how this could be either an incredibly moving emotional experience for audience members, or actually kind of make them uncomfortable, because this aria literally is singing to them.
Or both, you know,
right? So it's a real. I mean, the whole opera has a lot of standout pieces, but this one comes at the right spot in Act Two. That just, you know, it really helps us the empathy for this character. It's very deep. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel personally connected to Ottone at all as a character?
I do. I really do. I think that part of the people turning against you or plotting against you for reasons that you don't know and, you know, are really surprised about, because Ottone is a really genuine person. I'm not claiming that I'm to be an Ottone that's completely a genuine person, but he's really transparent, open, honest, and they're all plotting for other reasons and they decide to use him as a scapegoat. Right. You know, and I think we've all had experiences like that in our lives.
Yeah, it's a terrible feeling.
Yeah, it is. And you know what? I think that the first couple few times that happens to you in your life, it's like what's happening to Ottone in this piece. Certainly, we get more experience with it, I suppose, as we mature.
Right. But that confusion never goes away. And that feeling in the pit of your stomach that you know something's off or wrong, you just don't understand.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that probably out of all the Handel operas I ever sang or roles I ever did, this one feels the most like me.
Interesting.
Because he's just a normal soldier man, although I'm not a soldier, but just a normal person.
Yeah. He's trying to live his life well.
Yeah, I think so.
And then here's all these jerks come and derail him.
Well, it actually makes the story really great in that these characters are doing all this plotting, and they're vicious, but it's also comedic. It's funny. It's an opera seria, but it's still funny. But Ottone is not funny. He's just the sort of straight man in the piece, I suppose, and doesn't know it. He doesn't know he's a straight man.
Which is what makes the best. That's the best straight man, is the one that has absolutely no idea that that's his role in the moment.
Yeah.
Can you read just read the beginning of this aria?
Yes. So the first and only line of the A section is "Voi che udite il mio lamento, compatite il mio dolor." So you who hear my lament, take pity on my suffering. Hmm. And that's all directed right to the audience.
Brilliant.
It's simple. Yeah.
I think the most moving stuff is simple. And do you feel like if you didn't have an innate understanding of the music, of Handel's music, do you think Calzabigi's words would resonate the same way with you? Or do you think that they need each other in order to truly get into your heart the way that they do?
That's a really great question. You know, I actually haven't thought of that in that way. I think that they would stand mm-hmm. alone. But I think what's brilliant about Handel is the way he puts them together. So they would get into your heart, but I think the way Handel puts them together, they can't get out of your heart. You know, they're going to go in there and they're going to stay.
Yeah. I love that.
The way Handel writes it too is once the singing line is done and there's still some more music to go before the next part of it, words are still floating in your senses. Yeah. Like he's helping the words still float through, and the character's not saying anything at that moment, but you still hear them and feel them.
Well, because the emotion doesn't die just because the words end, huh? Mm-hmm. What's the B section?
Perdon trono e pur lo sprezzo, ma quel ben che tanto apprezzo, ai che perdo e tormento, che disanima il mio cor. I lose the throne and I scorn it. I scorn it all the more. But that treasure that I so prize, alas, the torment of losing it causes my heart to utterly despair. And what he's talking about is Claudio has promised him the throne for saving his life, Claudio. But Agrippina wants her son Nero to have the throne. Mm-hmm. So Ottone has told Agrippina that he loves Poppaea. So Agrippina tells Poppaea that I made a deal with Claudio to get the throne. And Claudio can then give Poppaea. Yeah.
It's so
very easy to follow.
But I think the gist of this here is that he's a good guy because he scorns he couldn't care less about power and money. He wants the love. And that in and of itself just says everything about his character. Yeah.
That's exactly right. That's what's really great about this character. It's the genuineness and understanding and desire for love. Just like you said, not power, not throne. Yeah. It's really very special. And it comes also at the right time in the opera. From what the characters have been doing before and all of their political actions and their scheming and some of the comedy and some of the treachery. Suddenly out of nowhere, there's this real genuine truth. Yeah. That someone's speaking to the audience directly from their heart. He's still singing that to the audience. Yeah. He's telling them, you all have seen me tell the truth. You all know that I don't want that. Help me. Help me. And I remember the first time we did it, oh my gosh, the way that you, Lillian, we sort of created the sort of super desperation at the end of the cadence, at the very end of the aria, that sort of desperation. Yep. And then there's that sort of realization that they can't help and that they're not going to help. And I felt the audience feel that. I felt it. Like I felt them going, we can't do anything. You can really feel that stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing. This is why we have to get back to live performances as soon as we are able, because that back and forth between a mass of people in the dark and the performer on stage is it's real and it's palpable. And
I really believe that the power of live operas is transformative. Yeah,
if you let it be. I think as an audience member, if you let it be.
Yeah.
If you walk in the door with a big open heart and you don't close yourself off to it, I think it's truly transformative.
I agree. And there's also something really quite amazing at sitting in the space and actually seeing someone doing it live and thinking, how are they doing that? Like, how are they singing that right now? Or how is that orchestra playing that right now? That on a CD or DVD, you're like, oh, sure, they probably may have done it in a few takes.
That's 15 takes they've put together. That's right. Yeah, no one does that.
At least 15. So that's, you know, to me, that's always the wonder of going. I never used to, when I was performing, I didn't go a lot to a lot of other operas just because we were always working and rehearsing. But I would always go to the fan. I was fans of a lot of singers or friends of a lot of singers. So I'd always try to go to theirs because I would just marvel at what they did, you know, or the breath support, the legato. This is another reason why I absolutely love this aria. It requires extraordinary singing on the breath and incredible legato. And it's hard. It's just as hard as like a really fast coloratura aria. Mm-hmm. But in the exact other way, it's just this the whole time.
Does when you're singing something that's that technically difficult, do you find that the emotional resonance of the piece helps with the technical side of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. It really does.
It's an honest question just because I'm not personally a singer. So I don't, I mean, I certainly know that as a dancer, it helps. The emotional resonance of a moment can help with the physicality of a technical thing. But yeah, I'm just curious what that does for a singer to be able to do both of those at the same time.
It does. And, you know, just speaking about the story in particular, I could tell as an artist, and we could tell as we were creating it, that the extraordinary technique in singing it as best as you can is going to help those emotions just go even more. So that it becomes this great, wonderful challenge to really serve the art and really, really serve the emotions and the text and the music. I guess I do miss performing sometimes. You know, I get that question a lot.
Yeah,
I do. And I miss the rehearsal process because that's just probably my most favorite time is the rehearsal and putting it together.
Just that moment, those moments of discovery and those moments of total disagreement. Mm-hmm. Like, I know that sounds like a weird thing to love, but I love it when two opinions come into the room and you have to like work out what that is. You know, I love that.
Yeah. You know, I admit when I was a younger singer, I probably didn't do that as well because I was probably a little more stubborn. But then I started to understand, you know what? Go for it. Try and see what that other artist, because then you start to trust other artists. Yeah. You know, I'm going to admit too on this show that I almost picked another piece that we were involved with together, which is Akhenaten.
Yeah. Were you going to talk about the hymn to the Aten?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
But I felt this one was so much more of a deeper. Akhenaten is beautiful and everything's fantastic about it. Great piece. And that production and our work together.
But this
aria in this moment for me is certainly one of the top five performing experiences I had for 20 years.
Wow.
Absolutely. Just a standout. I would say Handel's Partenope was a Glimmerglass New York City opera. And I think the title role of The Elephant Man.
Yes. I remember you sending me photos about from The Elephant Man at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's got to be a flight and a Midsummer's Dream in there too, but those are the top five or six. And this one's in there because of this aria and this text.
Wow.
And this music.
Yeah.
Oh, it was such, you know, when you get cast in certain roles, you're like, if you don't really know the opera that well yet, you're like, what? Look at all the arias.
Yeah, right.
You're like, I get this golden, delicious, beautiful moment.
Yep.
And I remember being first cast for that, and I just was just thrilled that that moment was going to come.
And now, here's my interview with Kelly Rourke. Kelly, I am so glad I was able to get you on this podcast. You are a woman who does it all when it comes to writing words and text within the operatic form. And I actually think you might have been the first dramaturg I ever met, which is kind of great. So welcome to Words First.
Such a pleasure to be here and to get to connect with you again.
Absolutely. So, you know, it's hard to know where to start with your work. But I actually want to go way back, and I want to talk about the fact that your degree is actually in piano performance. So can you tell me how you got from performing music to writing about and with music? And what about your musical training specifically prepared you for your current career?
So I actually, you know, way back when I was 17 years old and trying to map a plan for the rest of my life, the way 17-year-olds do, I was equally passionate about words and music. And I was a, quote, smart kid, therefore steered away from something crazy like music. You know, why would you waste that brain on, you know, such a terrible career path?
Right.
And so I was looking at degrees like in communications, because that sounded much more, you know, practical and grown up. And as I was looking at colleges, I also settled on the fact that I wanted to be in the DC area, because we'd gone on a class trip there. And again, 17-year-old making life decisions, narrowed my choices down to a school in that area. And there are lots of fine schools. So I went on a college visit, and I'm looking at communications programs, and I'm looking at English programs, and the choir director at my church, where I had a job playing every Sunday, said, "Oh, well, while you're looking at colleges in DC, you need to go visit Catholic University because they have an amazing music school." I said, "But I'm not majoring in music." "Yes, but you need to go because that music school is really great." "Yes, but I'm not majoring in music." And, you know, at a certain point, I realized I'll just go on the visit so that he will shut up.
Right.
And I went on the visit, and the people at the music school were really good recruiters. And I also realized, like, is majoring in music any less practical than majoring in English? Not really.
Right.
I still hedged my bets a little bit, because this was actually quite late. I already had acceptances and scholarships to other schools. And I think I was actually past the deadline to apply to the Roma School. And so I said, look, I'll apply. And if I get in and get money, I'm just going to do this thing. You know, 17 or 18, I guess I was 18. And I got in. And so I started this music degree. And, you know, I realized pretty quickly that I was not going to have a career as a performer, even though it was a performance degree. I just knew that I wanted to do something in that world. And so I guess it was my senior year, I started looking at internships. And I applied for an internship at a place called the Glimmerglass Opera.
that little unknown place up north.
that little unknown place. And, you know, it really, what took my breath away about that experience, because, you know, here I am, I'm doing a conservatory education. I'm spending, you know, 6 hours a day in a practice room, as are all of my friends. And loving that process. I got to Glimmerglass and I saw all of these amazing artists, whether they were performers, designers, directors. And it became clear pretty quickly that everyone who stepped into that rehearsal room on day one had been, you know, doing their equivalent of hours a day in a practice room, really preparing, thinking about getting ready to make this piece, honing their skills, developing some strong opinions about the story and the characters. And I watched these people who had done all of this work on their own get in a room together and start changing each other's minds. And I thought, whoa, that's really cool.
Can I just say, I think that is the best way of, I mean, I just think that's a really interesting way of describing the rehearsal process. Like a bunch of people who've done a lot of research getting into a room together and changing each other's minds. I think that's exactly how it goes. That's great. Sorry, keep going.
Okay, but that's what I love about it. You know, when people talk about falling in love with opera, you know, they say, oh, I saw this performance or I heard this Met broadcast and something about that music took my breath away. I never, you know, I had gone to operas. I liked them fine. But for me, it's as much the process as operas themselves mm-hmm. that is transformative and makes it a world that I want to live in. Mm-hmm. I also love opera and I love the human voice, but I love the process above all else.
Right. I love this path because I feel like in talking to librettists and for that matter, in talking to dramaturgs, talking to directors, I feel like so many of us take this sort of weird circuitous route and our niche is out there. It just takes us a while to find it. And so many times what I've heard is that the process and the collaborative process is what actually drew somebody to this space, as opposed to, like, as you mentioned, you know, a particular performance or et cetera. So I find that a really interesting path. So can we just talk about your work as a dramaturg? Did you start as you moved into this space that was not performative? Did you find yourself moving first into sort of work as a dramaturg, or did you find yourself writing libretti first, or did they sort of come together?
I definitely found myself working as a dramaturg first, and that really happened because of John Conklin. Uh-huh. You know, I entered Glimmerglass as an intern, and he saw me as someone who was really curious, really loved research, and he really started saying, oh, you should, you know, maybe do this, maybe read this, maybe you should write a program note. And so I kind of gradually started collecting and doing elements of the job before I got the title. Okay. And it was really a matter of following my nose, but also John noticing a curious, hardworking young person and steering them. Mm. You know, I never thought I want to be a librettist. What led me down the libretto path was meeting John Glover, who's a composer I work with a lot. Mm-hmm. And both of us love opera, love collaboration. And he said, let's do something together. So it wasn't, I want to abstractly write a libretto. It was, I want to make a thing with John. And that's really what led me down that path. I feel really lucky in that by the time I wrote my first libretto, I had deeply engaged with so many libretti. And right. I had been in the rehearsal room, you know, watching singers and directors, you know, what made their lives easy, what tripped them up. Making titles for shows, you know, you're also really intimately engaging with someone else's music and words put together. So I feel like that was the best possible training to just study all of these works. So that when John and I started talking about making a piece together, we could talk about things that we loved, things that were challenging, talk about shapes, and really, you know, start going.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was going to actually ask you if your super title work actually played into your ability to write libretti, and it sounds like it kind of did. That work actually lends itself to you learning about how something like that is structured.
For sure. I mean, when I'm looking for an intern every summer, I always tell them, you know, part of the perk of this job is you get an intensive score study over the course of the summer for four works for free. And you get to watch, you know, you're there at all the rehearsals. So you see how the conductor works with it. You see how the director works with it. You see how the singers work with it. You have to, your nose is in that score the whole summer. Mm-hmm. So that kind of study of the repertory, I think for me has been hugely important.
I want to ask you. We know from what you just said that John Glover was the person who sort of brought you into libretto writing. What was your first libretto?
My first libretto is kind of a quirky little piece called Lucy, and again, the repeating theme of this podcast is that John and I wanted to make something together. And then we got really excited about making something for our friend Andy Wilkowski.
Yep.
Who's just an amazing beast of a singer actor. And so, you know, the other thing is brand new team. We're not going to be commissioned to write a grand opera. Mm. Nor are we necessarily going to get commissioned to write anything. So we said, let's write something that is small so that somebody might be interested in taking it on, you know, something that is a little bit more modest forces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we wanted to write something for Andy. We went through a lot of ideas. Andy had this idea of something based on Howard Zinn. It was the kind of thing where we talked about it for probably a year. Uh-huh. What are we going to do? And then we came across this Radiolab story, true story about a guy who adopted a chimp as his daughter. Uh-huh. And we thought, oh, well, Andy can be the monkey daddy. It just seemed right. So that was the piece that we did. And, you know, as we were talking about how it works, and this piece that's a one man show, that was when people were first starting to use the term monodrama.
Right.
And we really thought the right form for this is like a dramatic song cycle. Uh-huh. In particular, John was really interested in Diary of One Who Disappeared, the Janáček.
Yeah.
So we kind of looked at that for cues, you know, because it is discrete songs, but they tell a story. You get a couple of other little voices in there, mm-hmm. for the character to react to. So that was the first libretto, sort of not what you think of when you think of an opera, but not exactly a song cycle either.
No, but I did read through it, and I find it fascinating. And I think the song form, I mean, do you like writing in song form versus something that you would think of more as like a through composed or an opera with recitative and aria?
I do, you know, and I've had a couple of opportunities over the pandemic to write songs, especially for singers. Uh-huh. Which was a lot of fun, you know, to think about something that is for an artist you admire.
Yeah.
Although that's different than linked songs that tell a story, which is what Lucy was.
Sure. Speaking of song cycles a little bit, I just want to talk briefly, because I realized on your website that I didn't realize you were involved with this, and then we're talking about Andrew Kowalski. If we can talk briefly about Guns N' Roses and Cavalier.
Yes.
I saw this in New York. And just had such a great time with it. And I'm just curious about the inspiration for this. It is song cycly, but it's also almost a pastiche. And it just was such an interesting mashup. And I just would love to hear a little bit of your thoughts about that piece.
Sure. That's another show that actually came out of Glimmerglass, because Andy Wood at Limekiln sit at the piano, and he had this whole kind of power ballad medley that he would play. And he and John actually had started off talking about, you know, wanting to do a recital that's a mashup of a classical recital and a rock concert.
Right.
And, you know, doing rock songs like they were art songs, and doing art songs like they were rock songs, and uh-huh. everything in between. Uh-huh. So that was the genesis of that idea. Uh-huh. And then, as you know, so Andy and John did some really wild arrangements. They brought in Genghis Barbie,
right.
Which is an amazing post-feminist, all-female French horn, quartet. And then I did some lyrics for art songs, uh-huh. trying to make them sound like more like pop songs.
Yeah, I have to say, it was one of the more fascinating evenings of cabaret, which essentially that's what it felt like, is sort of a cabaret experience. Just knowing the artists that were in there, but just this idea of fusion of genres, the way that it happened was kind of amazing.
I was just going to say, it was so interesting doing it at Rockwood, because when we did it before, we had done it under the auspices of opera companies.
Sure.
And so the things that people react to, the little surprises, are different. Mm. You know, the Rockwood crowd in general got things that the opera crowd in general didn't get. You know, mm-hmm. there were always people at the show that got all of it, but right. it was interesting the general reaction and how it was different depending on the venue.
Of course, yeah. I mean, that's always talk about, like, one of the characters actually being the audience who's watching, and I'm sure it changed the way the show was presented just in and of itself because of what the audience was taking from it. I want to switch gears slightly and actually talk about your youth operas. You've written several of them. And I read a little bit of Odyssey that you did for Glimmerglass in 2015.
which is a history or a mythological play of sorts, and it's written in rhyme, has some, it's really witty, actually. It has some very witty moments. And I'm curious what you do differently when you write libretti or songs or a piece for youth opera than when you're writing something that might be presented more main stage, or what I hesitated to call it adult opera, but something that is on the other side of that.
It's a great question. I don't actually believe in youth opera mm-hmm. or art for kids. Mm-hmm. By that, I mean, I didn't grow up seeing shows for children. Yeah. And I think a lot of people who have found their way in this field didn't necessarily find their way from going to kiddie shows. You know, I grew up more with seeing musicals, and I didn't get everything. A lot of it went over my head, but I still loved it. Mm-hmm. And when Ben and I got commissioned to write this piece, one of the first things we talked about was this idea, and the idea that probably half our audience, and certainly the audience that was paying to be there, was going to be adults. And so we didn't want it to be something that would bore them. Mm-hmm. And kids are a lot smarter than you give them credit for.
Yes,
and one of the things we talked about was all of these great animated films that you see now, mm-hmm. and how a kid can follow the story, totally enjoy the story, and there's all of this stuff happening at another level that makes the adults enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And that was really our goal. So as to whether I write differently when the audience is kids or adults, I would say no.
Great.
I think, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into this later on, I like to think that I write differently for every composer that I work with. And I don't know if you listened to Odyssey at all, but Ben is like the most amazing old school melodist in the world. Mm-hmm. Like, he's a great songwriter. So when you talk about the form and the rhymes, that totally makes sense for Ben. Mm-hmm. You know, the next piece that I did for kids, I wrote with Laura Cartman, or that I did for kids and their parents.
Right.
I wrote with Laura Cartman, and there's very little rhyme in that because that's not who she is as a composer.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that's really interesting that it's almost less about the fact that it's for youth and more about the fact that it just depends on who it is that you're writing with. And this is actually a question that I bring up quite a bit. And so let's take the diversion right now, because I think it's a really interesting concept of how you approach a piece when you write it. Do you approach every piece the same way, or do you, like you've already said, like you approach different composers differently? But can you talk about just the way that you approach writing a piece from the get-go, and does it change based on a multitude of factors, or do you find that you always sort of have the same path?
Yeah, it changes a lot. And actually, I think one of the biggest things that influences what happens is even beyond me getting to know the composer, and that is, what's the commission? Mm. I have never yet had the experience, maybe I will in like 30 years, where an opera company approaches me and a composer and says, do whatever you want.
That's the dream.
So, you know, for instance, a big influence on Odyssey, which influenced how I wrote, but also influenced the story that we chose, because Francesca said, you know, it should be a familiar story, but public domain, mm. and it should feature the kids, mm-hmm. and include two young artists.
Uh-huh.
So and be an hour long and be with piano. So already we've learned a lot. That's set a lot of limits.
Mm-hmm.
I love limits. I hate the blank page.
Uh-huh.
So once you start getting some boundaries in there, then it's like, okay, what can we make within that boundary?
Yeah.
So that's really thing one. And that was an interesting thing also with Lucy, where we were like, we basically want to make a one-man chamber opera, because then maybe someone will take a chance and do it.
Right.
But the other part of it very much is getting to know the composer and his or her music, and trying to think about, like, how can what I write inspire them to do the thing that they do?
Mm-hmm. When you're coming up with a story, do you find that you're the one that brings it to the table, or is it often brought to the table on by the composer or by the people who are handing you the brief?
I have had every situation. Mm. Sometimes again with the brief, it's like with all of the youth operas, it has been familiar story, public domain, can be told in an hour. So that's very limiting already. But sometimes it's, what do you want to make? I have another project that I'm working on now where the composer and I are totally free to choose the subject. It'll be an original subject.
Uh-huh.
And it's been really fun because we actually have some time and some spaciousness.
Yeah.
And it's someone I didn't know before. And we have, over the past few months, just been sending each other poems, stories. She's been sending me a lot of music, not just her music, saying, oh, I really like this about this piece.
Mm.
So we're having this kind of long getting to know you and gradually honing in on a story that that hits both of our interests.
Uh-huh.
And I hope provides space for some of the kinds of musical things she's interested in exploring.
You've done a number of pieces with John Glover, and then you have a whole array of people that you've worked with. And what's it like to first do an introduction with a composer? I mean, you've talked a little bit about just handing things back and forth. Is it an easy process for you? Is it a process you enjoy, or does it depend on the person? And have you had certain people that you've started to work with and realized that it's just not gonna vibe the right way?
You know, it's a process I enjoy, except on the days that I don't.
Right? Sure.
I mean, do you enjoy relationships? Yes, except on the days where you're like, what are you talking about?
Right.
So, you know, some are easier than others.
Uh-huh.
You know, John and I are longtime collaborators and best of friends, and we still like have moments where we get really mad at each other.
Yeah.
And I think the trick there is to remind yourself and remind each other that the reason we're, you know, getting into these dark emotions is because we're so passionate about the project.
Right.
You know, I think if you're never struggling, then maybe you might be phoning it in. I don't know. So, you know, not that I can always remind myself of that, but that is how to get out of it.
Well, I think a lot of times when you're in the middle of it, don't you? I mean, I think it's impossible to know that you're in the middle of that kind of artistic, for lack of a better word, artistic agony. You know, I think we don't know when we're in the middle of it. It's only on the other side that we can look back and say, oh,
exactly.
It was passionate.
Yeah. It's because we both care.
Yeah.
And you're wrong. No.
Yeah.
The other thing that I try to remind myself in challenging collaborations is I am really honing my collaboration skills.
Yeah.
I am learning new things. I have to, you know, or abandon the project. And usually there are too many, this business is too small, and it's usually, you know, it's not just me and the composer. There are usually, because of opera's planning process, a lot of people who are already involved, and usually there's someone else on the project that I care about, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's finding the way forward for all of us.
Right. Yeah. There is something about developing those diplomatic skills while you're standing in the fireplace that makes that really strengthens your ability to just make no matter what's happening.
Yeah.
Can you, this is an honest question about, are you able to talk about Eat the Document?
Yep.
Great. So I want to talk about Eat the Document, which is also with John Glover. And you know, I read what you sent me. You sent me just a little sampling of it. And first of all, I love that this is an adaptation that you're doing. And I'm just it's a political piece in some ways and a piece about identity and family in others. And I just want to know what made you want to adapt it and what are your plans for the piece?
So I read Dana Spiotta's book shortly after it was published, and it was a book. It was one of those books that I kind of dropped everything so that I could finish it through to the end. And then I got to the end and I turned back to the beginning and started it again. I fell in love with the book. I loved the way that it dealt with politics and the way that it dealt with young people trying to find their way in the world. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think that's, you know, yes, we're following this story, which we can talk about in a minute, but we're also looking at young people in the 70s who mm-hmm. were looking around them and at their world and saying, this is not acceptable. And each of them making a different decision and then dealing with the consequences of those decisions.
Right.
And then you have that overlaid with young people in the 90s who are also looking at their world and saying, this is not acceptable. And that question of how do I respond to something that I find unacceptable? Mm-hmm. And then again, looking at the consequences of it. I just thought it was really brilliant the way that she wove all of those different personalities together. But the other reason that I was interested in making an opera out of it, and John as well, is the form of it. Mm. I think not all great books want to be operas. I think that's often a mistake. Someone reads a book and they're like, let's make it an opera. And then you lose what made it a great book.
Right.
But the particular form of this novel is that each chapter is told by a different character. Mm. And so, you know, you could feel the arias, you could feel the shifting points of view. It made sense to us how you might translate it to music theater. Right. Some of Dana's other novels, and Dana's a good friend as well. Uh-huh. I am her fan and her friend. Some of her other novels, they're all fantastic. I recommend them. Some of her other books, what is so great about them is what they do with the form of the novel. Uh-huh. And the way they play with that form. Uh-huh. And yes, you could pluck those characters out and you could tell their story and you would have lost a major point of what she was doing as an artist. Hmm. Whereas Eat the Document is a little bit more straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Can you, what I love about, I mean, I didn't even think about the fact that it's told with different points of view. It's very, there's a sort of like what Faulkner does in some of his stories. But I love the way that it plays with time, that it's not linear in any way. And I think, you know, when I think about things that translate to opera, I think, not that you can't do a linear story with opera, of course, tons of them are, but there's something about the abstraction of time that lends itself, or that opera can take and carry in a way that I don't see necessarily in other forms as easily. Can you talk a little about the story and how you play with time musically as well?
Sure. So the basic thread of the story is that we meet one of our lead characters and quickly come to understand, it's the 70s, we quickly come to understand that she has been involved in some radical protests against the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. One has gone terribly wrong, and someone has gotten killed, someone innocent. And she and her boyfriend, who are sort of leading this band of activists, have to separate, go underground, find new identities, maybe never see each other again.
Right.
And so we have one thread of the story, which is following Mary, who becomes Caroline, who becomes Louise, mm-hmm. and some other people as well, following her in the immediate aftermath as she's trying to create a new identity and basically just stay alive, stay out of jail. And so as we follow her on her journey, you know, we meet up with various other kinds of people. So that's the 70s. Mm-hmm. And then in the late 90s, we find out that she has indeed survived. She's made a new life. She is a single mother living in suburbia with a teenage son. Mm-hmm. And the teenage son is beginning to ask some questions that she can't answer. Also in the 90s, we have this kind of anarchist bookstore where we have, you know, the disaffected youth of the 90s who are, again, they find what's going on around them unacceptable, and they're trying to figure out how they push back.
Yeah, I remember those anarchist bookstores, those radical bookstores as a disaffected youth in the 90s.
Yeah. So those are the kind of two strands that we're following, and they come together in the end, you know. And so there is this plot of, is Jason going to solve the mystery of his mother?
Sure.
But there's also this unfurling theme about how do you respond and what are the consequences?
Mm-hmm. Is this your first like full-length opera? That's not, or have you written others that are, because this what I did notice about this one is that it says it's a full-length opera. This is a full evening. Are you looking at this as a large orchestra? Is this a larger piece, or are you looking at this more as a smaller sort of chamber? I know there's some like pop music ideas in it. I'm just curious what your plans are as you move forward with it.
It is a full evening, but I think the full evening is 90 minutes.
Right.
I love a good 90-minute opera. I'm not just saying that because I'm too lazy to write a longer piece. I like going to 90-minute operas. I like skipping the intermission. I like just that start at the beginning and go to the end.
Yep, I agree.
For me, that's really satisfying. The ensemble is, it's not a full symphony orchestra. We think that's not what the story wants anyway.
Yep.
But it's going to be a combination. The book references a lot of pop music, and part of the fun for us, because for all of these disaffected youth in the 70s and in the 90s, they really get their ideas about who they are, to a certain extent from pop music. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the character development. Now in the book, Dana writes really specifically about a lot of specific artists. We will not be sampling the Beach Boys. Mm. But what's been fun in our conversations and in our work is, as the characters talk about how this music makes them feel, how do we do that within our musical landscape? You know, so like what does a sound world, what does a Beach Boys sound world sound like? And again, we're never going to say Beach Boys, and we're not even going to do like, you know, Beach Boys-ish, but like what's our digested version of what that feels
right.
like?
Yeah.
But, you know, they're like, it will be choral, you know,
sure.
like that kind of thing.
Yeah. I love that. I think as we continue to tell our stories now, our contemporary stories, that those sounds will start to make their way into the greater landscape. They must, because it is part of us. Is this a commission, or are you writing this without a home as of yet?
Well, so we're developing it with AOP.
Oh, fantastic!
So we're that's the American Opera Project for listeners.
Yep.
Wonderful organization, and in fact, they we started developing Lucy with them way back in the day.
We're starting to come towards the end of our time, so I want to actually have one more big question. I want to actually chat about some of your translation work, because you've done some English translations of some existing works. I actually seem to remember, did you do the translation for Orpheus in the Underworld at Glimmerglass? Was that you?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
So I know, so I've heard some of your translation work. I remember that was the year I was, the one of the 2 years that I was there. But can you just talk to me about what it's like to translate a work versus, you know, of course, coming up with it on your own, or versus translating it for a super title? What's it like actually sitting down and trying to find the English that will go with the music that's already existing?
It's interesting, you know, people will say translation isn't actually possible, right? Sure. Which is in a lot of ways true. And mm-hmm. I think you have to make choices and be clear with yourself about your priorities. Mm-hmm. And so where I have come, my priorities, and it's shifted a little bit over time, but I would say my overarching priority at the moment is to make people think that this music was written to my English lyric.
Mm.
That I want to be that closely wedded to the text mm-hmm. or closely wedded to the music in every way. And I don't just mean emphasis on the right syllable.
Sure.
I mean, like, why is that a high note? I need to put a word on that high note that the composer would have said, oh, that's a high note.
Sure.
So it's that level. And, you know, that's depending on the syntax of the language, the original language, that may mean it's a totally different thing happening on that phrase.
Right.
So I want to be true to the story. But I want people to buy that music was made for those words, which sometimes means, you know, kind of going away a little bit from what was originally there. Mm-hmm. So many people say, oh, English is, you know, it's just not a pretty language for singing, which, I mean, can I curse on this podcast? I have some words about that. English is a gorgeous language.
It is. I agree.
Come on. But I think there are a lot of bad singing translations out there.
Yeah.
So I want it to sound right and I want it to sound good.
Mm-hmm.
So that is my priority. You know, lots of other things are important too. I do want to, you know, to honor the ideas of the original poet, librettist, yeah. whatever that person is.
Sure.
But I don't think they're honored when things are awkward in the music.
True.
So I want to honor the whole.
Do you enjoy doing this work? Is it something you like doing, the translations?
You know, it's like all these other questions, right? I love doing it. And there are days when I get,
sure.
when I spend a day on a couplet, you know, and it's just like, what is the solution to that? I am going to solve it. I'm going to solve that somehow. Days it's like easy fun and some days it's hard fun.
Well, here, so let me ask it to you this way. Do you have a translation that you've done that was particularly fun to do?
Well, I actually just did one, and this is something I have coming up that I haven't mentioned, but it has been announced. And the Met has on their docket for next December an adapted version of their production of Cendrillon.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, in that family opera slot, so it's like
yep.
90 minutes. Again, 90-minute opera.
Perfect.
Love it. I don't know if you saw that production.
This is the one with the words.
Yes.
It's really gorgeous.
It's a gorgeous, fun production. I'm really excited about it. And part of the, you know, the challenge is I watched the production. It was like, oh, there are all of these French words and things are made out of words. How do we make that make sense in an English version? Mm-hmm. And so, what I came up with, which I think is going to be a lot of fun, is using French cognates whenever possible, using, you know, French words that are in English.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of fun to work on. And the Met dramaturg, Paul Cremo, is
yep.
a fantastic sort of collaborator, fantastic person to work with as I developed that.
Kelly Rourke, thank you. So much. This has been really fantastic. And I coming up with what I wanted to ask you, it's like I just went in 4,000 directions because you, you know, you do your dramaturgy work, you do these translations, you do libretti, you write libretti. Do you find that they all sort of fit together? I think this is how I want to ask this. Do you find that they all sort of fit together in a good puzzle for you, or do you sometimes find that they bounce up against each other?
I think it's a good puzzle because is there some dumb metaphor with like cross training here? I think maybe. because, you know, it's similar skills, but I exercise them differently.
Uh-huh.
But it's also that the sort of cross training metaphor, if it works at all, I think is true going from one composer to the next.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, this is how I do things. Oh, but I have to do them a little different.
Yeah.
Oh, I have to do them a little different.
Yeah.
You know, and working with singing translations, I feel is exactly like being a librettist, except the composer is dead.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. In that, you know, so there's no flexibility. Like right. I have the back and forth with a living composer. With a dead composer, they have thrown down the gauntlet and I must match them. but I get the last word.
Yes, you do. Thank you so much.
So.
that's wonderful. Thank you. I'm so happy to talk to you today.
Many thanks to Kelly Rourke and David Walker for their candor and eloquence in speaking about their artistic process and the words they cherish. Tune in next week for two absolute mavericks in the opera business, librettist and self-described maker Cerise Jacobs and director, playwright, and translator Lillian Groag. It's going to be a spicy episode. Thank you for listening. I'm Keturah Stickhan. If you'd like to hear these interviews in their entirety, as well as bonus materials and outtakes, you can become a patron of my podcast by going to patreon.com/wordsfirstpodcast. That's patreon.com/wordsfirstpodcast. All of my episodes from every season are available at wordsfirst.buzzsprout.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Words First is recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. A special thanks to Matthew Doucet and Richard Stickhan for their generous support, Early Doucet for a beautiful watercolored logo, Eileen Downey for the Mozart, and Randy Ravioli for the minimal barking. Until next time, take care of each other. And keep telling stories.